I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Dan Rodericks. On the second hour of Midday Friday, Governor Martin O'Malley last week, in a rare use of veto power, blocked a bill that would have potentially shut down a proposed wind energy farm in Somerset County. The likely presidential candidate's move has upset some lawmakers in Annapolis, despite the fact that the project is expected to create more than 500 jobs and make the state more energy independent. We'll discuss the controversy with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Also on the green energy front, Baltimore's Inner Harbor is now home to the nation's first permanent solar-powered trash-sucking water wheel, which is projected to collect around 50,000 pounds of waste a day. We'll talk with one of the men who designed the wheel and hear about how it works. And a Memorial Day commemoration with a local musician who performs weekly for wounded veterans at Walter Reed National Military Center. That's coming up after the news. Welcome back to Midday Friday. I'm Nathan Sterner, filling in for Dan Rodericks in this second hour of our show. A little later in the hour, a musical commemoration of Memorial Day with Carolyn Surik. Surik is a member of Trio Galilei, a Celtic music group that performs weekly for wounded veterans at the Walter Reed National Military Center in Washington, D.C. She'll join us in studio to talk about music and about the importance of honoring our servicemen and women. Also, Baltimore is home to the nation's first trash-sucking water wheel. The solar-powered device was installed in the Inner Harbor a couple weeks ago, and it's projected to remove some 50,000 pounds of trash from the water each day. We'll talk with one of the water wheel's designers and operators later this hour. Up front, though, Governor Martin O'Malley used his veto power a week ago today to block a bill that would have delayed and possibly completely prevented the construction of a wind energy farm in Somerset County. The veto has been praised by environmentalists, but many lawmakers in Annapolis and in Washington, D.C. are not happy with this decision. Here to discuss this controversy is regular Midday contributor Rona Cabell, staff writer for the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Rona, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And before we talk about the wind energy farm, I want to go back to a topic that we discussed in the last hour of Midday Friday, plastic bags, the potential plastic bag tax in Baltimore City. You were listening to our conversation, and I know that you had a few things that you wanted to add.
Right. I just wanted to say that trash is not just an unsightly issue. It's a serious health concern as well. We are just starting to understand the toxics that are embedded in plastic bags. Plastic bags are made, their base made out of oil, and when they sit in the water, they can release toxics. And the Baltimore Inner Harbor Partnership is going to be monitoring some of this trash with the new trash wheel. But I just want people to understand, as a person who sometimes does forget her own bags, that this is not just merely an issue of convenience and of aesthetics. It's also a serious health concern, and it's becoming more of one.
And plastic bags, when they get into the waters, not so much in the Chesapeake Bay, but in larger bodies of waters. Aren't there these giant gyres of plastics floating in the Atlantic and the Pacific, like huge, huge patches of just slightly underwater plastics?
Yes, that's true. And they are very harmful to fish. Particularly, we know about the six-pack of soda, the plastic rings. They get in the way of birds and fish. They kill many marine animals who consume the plastic because they assume it's food. And as Julie Lawson, who was here earlier, before her current position with the Maryland, Trash Free Maryland, she worked for the Anacostia Watershed Society, which works with the Potomac River groups to organize a huge trash cleanup. And they've seen a 60% drop in the areas that have the plastic bag fee and the areas that don't, which is fairly significant.
And we'll be talking a bit more about plastic bags in the water and getting them out of the water and later this hour as you talk about the water wheel.
With the trash wheel, yes.
Yeah, which is pretty interesting. But now to the wind bill. As I mentioned, Governor O'Malley a week ago vetoed this bill that would have delayed and the developers say essentially killed the wind farm project on the Eastern Shore. Tell us a little bit more background to this bill. Do we even know why the bill was put in place in the first place? Give us some background as to the agreements between the developer and to Pax River.
Well, as I said in my blog post today, it really is a mystery how this bill came about. So a group called Pioneer Green, which is based in Austin, for about 4 years, they've been working to develop a wind farm in Somerset County. They've opened up an office in Princess Anne. Paul Harris, who's their development manager, moved down to Princess Anne. He got himself on the Chamber of Commerce. He became a local. He got the support of the superintendent, of the Farm Bureau, of all the interested people down in Somerset County, which is one of Maryland's poorest counties and where most of the stable jobs right now are either as a prison guard or at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. The rest of the county subsists on either county government jobs or farming, predominantly chicken farming. So having an additional source of income to be able to keep your farm was hugely popular down there. And it was rolling along without much problem until Steny Hoyer asked that this bill be introduced by the Southern Maryland delegation to delay the project for a year. Now, the reason behind the delay was that it might infringe on the radar at the Pax River Naval Air Station down in St. Mary's County. But the Navy had said that they had worked a deal out with the wind farm and they were okay with having access to the switch to turn off the turbines during radar testing.
Exactly. The developer said that, yes, indeed, the rotating wind turbines or turbines, I guess it depends on if you're a journalist or if you're a turbine creator, how you pronounce that word. They acknowledged that the rotating wind turbines would get in the way of radar, and they said, so we've agreed to turn them off anytime Pax River wants to turn them off, so there wouldn't be an issue.
Right, and earlier, the Navy had signed off on that, but they didn't actually literally sign. They entered into an agreement, which they did not sign, but they sort of verbally agreed. And then they were going to sign it. And then Congressman Hoyer asked them to hold off on signing it while this was all worked out.
So Congressman Hoyer told Pax River not to sign this bill, not Pax River told Congressman Hoyer to put the bill in place.
It was either someone at Pax River who Hoyer spoke with or someone higher up at the Pentagon. But the opposition to the wind bill did not come from the Navy. And I should add that of the military forces, the Navy has been among the most proactive on climate change issues. They have a large presence in Norfolk. Norfolk, next to New Orleans, is the city that has to deal the most with both sea level rise and land subsidence. They're very aware of climate change. They've spent billions of dollars to protect their investments down in Norfolk. So it doesn't surprise me that they were at least theoretically supportive of the wind farm and willing to do what they could to make it happen. What is surprising is why Steny Hoyer was so against it.
And that's what I'm trying to get to the bottom of. You said the Navy was theoretically in favor of the wind farm. Do you think there's a possibility they were not practically in favor of the wind farm?
I think that the opposition seems to have come from some influential contractors at Pax River. Pax River is a economic engine in Southern Maryland. It is directly and indirectly responsible for 20,000 jobs. If you've been down there anytime recently, you can see that it's booming. And the Navy, Pax River, is the engine of that. But from all the people I talked to, they had assurances from the Navy that this was not going to be a problem. And the alleged cause is that maybe the base could close down because of a base realignment and closure act procedure strikes me as extremely unlikely, because there isn't even such a procedure going on right now in Congress.
Won't be for another 6 years.
And even
at the earliest.
Right. And even when that does happen, statistically, in the last several years, those base closures have benefited Maryland and Virginia. Fort Meade, Aberdeen, St. Mary's, all of those places are adding jobs and expanding, not cutting jobs and contracting.
Then what would the opposition be?
Well, I guess there's a powerful fear that if it did infringe on the radar, then they could move. But as I said, this seems highly unlikely. And who knows if in 10 years, Pax River will still be even using the same radar. So as I said, this is a real big mystery. And most of the people I talked to really didn't understand where the opposition was coming from, only that the opposition was strong. 112 state delegates voted in favor of this bill. Steny Hoyer was pushing it. Barbara Mikulski, Senator Cardin, and Congressman Rupersberger all backed Hoyer.
So even though we don't know why there was opposition, we know there was strong opposition, a
right,
widespread opposition. Hoyer said that the bill was passed with a strong veto-proof majority, but of course it was vetoed. Talk about the reasons O'Malley had for vetoing this bill and for pushing this wind project to go forward.
Well, if he had one reason to let the bill stand, he had many reasons to veto it. This bill would have created more than 500 jobs in an economically depressed county, or the veto allows, I should say. This is kind of hard to talk about because he vetoed something that is now going to pass. So it creates jobs. He's talked very passionately about wind energy. His administration has supported an increase of the renewable portfolio standard, which basically requires the state of Maryland to buy more renewable energy. He pushed hard for the offshore wind farm that that legislation passed off of Ocean City. He connects really well with young people. He just gave a graduation address at the University of Maryland where he spoke passionately about climate change. He's also spoken passionately about the rural Maryland and keeping and saving these rural places we have. This had the support of the local people down there, the farmers, the local government. And I think he's seen for himself from the hurricane centers around the state the devastation that these storms can have. And he understands that climate change is fueling those things and that if we don't become serious about renewable energy, we're never going to have a chance at making these less serious. And the other thing, of course, is just the huge economic benefit and the message that it would send to companies doing business in Maryland that, hey, at the last minute, we can pull the rug out from under you. So, I mean, this company in good faith was negotiating for 4 years, spent $4 million to build this wind farm. And then with a stroke of a pen and a legislative session, it could all be taken away.
Governor O'Malley is, of course, expected to run for the presidency in 2016. He's not going to have to work with the General Assembly again now that this session is done, unless there is a special session called for an override of the veto, which has been discussed, although does it seem like anyone's pushing for that actively?
No. This would be a very expensive endeavor. It was done a couple years ago, I believe, for gambling. Which, of course, was...
But O'Malley was in favor of calling that session.
He was in favor of calling that session, and gambling, for better or for worse, is going to have a huge impact on the state. It was something that many people were pushing. I really don't think that there will be a special session. I've been wrong before, so maybe. But I'm not hearing about anybody who has any power in Annapolis pushing for one. Now, Steny Hoyer might very much want one, but he's in Congress, right? So, it's been really interesting to kind of watch this play out.
And of course, this could conceivably help O'Malley with his presidential bid, assuming he mounts one.
Yes, but I think it's important to say that I don't think that's why he did this. A lot of cynical people, and I can be as cynical as anyone, would say that, oh, if he wants to win Iowa, Iowa's really big into wind, and he needs to show that he supports wind and that he's going to subsidize it. And I agree with that, sure, but I think he's spoken enough about renewable energy and has showed his passion enough on the topic that I think he did this because he really believes that it was the right thing to do, and not so much for political calculations.
Well, let me trot out your cynicism and political calculations. Two of the three top Democrats running to succeed O'Malley as governor have been very noncommittal about this issue. Both Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown and State Attorney General Doug Ganser have not said what they would have done were they in O'Malley's shoes and this bill came before them. They wouldn't say whether they would have vetoed it or not.
Well, they, fortunately for them, were not in the position when called to make the decision. I think it points to how powerful Hoyer, Mikulski, Cardin, Rupersberger, and the Southern Maryland delegation are, that these folks are not standing up behind O'Malley, especially Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, who presumably has worked very closely with the governor. I think maybe it's smart politically to be noncommittal since nobody will ever ask them to veto it because it's already been done. But, you know, to me, it shows how courageous O'Malley was because he hasn't vetoed too many things. He didn't show his cards. We didn't know he was going to veto this. And I think he really went by his own convictions, which is something every governor has to decide what their convictions are and act on them. And in this case, he did that.
And this is the 13th piece of legislation that O'Malley has vetoed in the entirety of his 8 years as governor. And also, I suppose it should be noted that the third top Democrat running for the governor's seat, Montgomery County Delegate Heather Mazier, voted against the bill in the first place and was in favor of the veto.
Yes.
So anything else to discuss on this? Any reasons that this wind farm is not going to go forward now? Is it just steaming into the future?
Well, unlike the other wind farm, the offshore one that I mentioned earlier, that is going to need a lot of federal permits. Building wind turbines in the ocean isn't the easiest thing to do. You can imagine the Army Corps of Engineers is going to have something to say about it. NOAA is going to have something to say about it. There are a lot of factors involved in that, and I don't think that's going to happen for another decade. If there is no more opposition to the wind farm in Somerset County, I think that we could start seeing turbines in the area in a year or two. Maybe that's optimistic, but what you need to put together a 600-foot turbine is maybe not as difficult as it sounds. They're making them. There are wind farms in Pennsylvania. There are wind farms in Canada, Germany.
There are wind farms in Western Maryland.
There are wind farms in Western Maryland. So clearly the technology is available and could be accessed. So I don't think it's going to take that long. It might take some time to sort of negotiate these leases with farmers and some other things, but I think we could see the wind farm pretty soon, whereas the other wind effort, the bigger wind effort that we saw with the bill that passed a couple years
ago.
The
offshore wind effort.
Yes, I think that is pretty far into the future.
Rona Cabell is staff writer for the Chesapeake Bay Journal and regularly joins Dan Rodericks for our recurring Midday on the Bay show. Rona, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Midday Friday here on Your Public Radio. When we get back, we'll be joined by Daniel Chase of Clearwater Mills. He is the co-designer and operator of a new solar-powered trash intercepting device that may help the Inner Harbor reach the goal of becoming swimmable and fishable by the year 2020. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Midday Friday. I'm Nathan Sterner, filling in for Dan Rodericks today. Still to come this hour, we talk with a Celtic musician who performs for wounded veterans each week at the Walter Reed National Military Center in Washington, D.C. But first, we're joined by Daniel Chase of Clearwater Mills. Chase is one of the designers and operators of the nation's first permanent solar-powered trash-intercepting water wheel, located in Baltimore's Inner Harbor. The wheel was installed a couple weeks ago. It's currently up and running. Could this mean the harbor might actually be made fishable or even swimmable by the year 2020? Daniel Chase is here in Studio A to answer those questions, talk about the wheel, how it was conceived, and what it could mean for Baltimore's most visited waterfront. Daniel Chase, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, nice to see you.
Describe the wheel.
The wheel is a 50-foot long, 30-foot wide barge with a 14-foot wheel on it.
14 feet in diameter?
Yes,
or
that picks up trash as it comes down the Jones Falls River.
How does it collect the trash?
The trash comes down whenever there's a rain event. The current brings it to us. The deployment booms that we have out guide it to a conveyor at the front of the barge.
So the deployment booms are basically kind of a funnel
a
that
funnel.
Sits on top
right.
of the water, and everything that gets stuck inside those, how big are those booms?
They have a 24-inch skirt that goes down into the water,
mm-hmm.
and then about a 7-inch flotation at the top, so everyone's seen them. It's orange.
And when they're stretched out, how much water gets funneled into the...
The entire river.
Oh, the entire river?
The entire surface of the river. The skirt is 24 inches long to try and help get some of the plastic bags and buoyantly neutral trash that easily goes under it because of the flow.
Mm-hmm.
We try to get the boom a little deeper to try and stop that.
Buoyantly neutral trash?
Yes.
What's buoyantly neutral trash?
It will go wherever the water goes. It won't
okay.
float to the surface.
Okay, so the trash that's just below the surface, you can see it floating along,
right.
but it's not
Everyone
above.
Sees the styrofoam and the plastic that sits right on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a fair amount of plastic that just is
just
a
heavy
foot
enough
below the
to
water.
Be below,
right.
but certainly still floating along.
Right.
And 50,000 or
it's capable of picking up 50,000 pounds a day. For instance, that last storm we had 4 or 5 days ago. We picked up approximately 40,000 pounds of trash in a 10-hour period.
40,000 in a 10-hour period. Wow.
There's an endless supply coming down the Jones Falls.
And you're pulling all of it out. What do you do with that trash once you
It goes into a dumpster that sits in the back of the barge, and it sits on a separate float, so we can come in with a motorboat, hook up to the dumpster barge, take it to a boat ramp, and then a regular roll-off truck comes and picks up the container and takes it to get incinerated. Currently, they're still debating whether or not to landfill, maybe recycle, so...
But at this point, the trash gets incinerated.
Right.
40,000 pounds just this last storm. It's a pretty big barge, I would expect.
It is.
Do you have multiple barges that you come in and change
out? We have
out?
Two dumpster floats, and we have three actual dumpsters, so that we can take one out when it's full, put another one in, and keep loading it as the full one gets emptied.
What's the composition, at least from the 2 weeks you've been running, what's the composition of the trash that's being sucked up by the water wheel?
A little bit of everything. A lot of natural debris. Leaves, sticks, pollen, blossoms, that kind of stuff. And then,
stuff
of course,
that you don't really want in the water, but it's not...
Right. It's natural debris, but it gets much more than it used to in that, you know, it used to be just a stream bed.
Right. Now we have all the developments, which makes it far easier for stuff that wouldn't have normally been swept into the bed.
Storm drains bring it
in.
Back from
right.
blocks away. And that does come into the harbor, and it basically creates a form of a compost pile that sits there and breaks down, sucking oxygen out of the water.
Which is not good for wildlife.
And on top of all that, we, of course, have all of the plastics and debris that come down with it.
I saw a video of perhaps the first tire to show up
inside
the water wheel.
Yes, that was, in fact, our first tire to go up, along with pallets, logs, and everything else.
You've only been running for 2 weeks. Is there anything even weirder than a tire that you've seen wash in?
Actually, our helper, Nate... Appleby Kellett found a half-eaten container of ice cream. Still frozen.
What kind?
I'm not sure.
See if I could figure out why they wouldn't want to finish that ice cream. So this is actually the second water wheel that you've been involved with in the Inner Harbor.
It is. The first one, the prototype we did, Able Foundation helped finance it, and then the city purchased it from us. We had an 8-month trial period in the Jones Falls, at which point we were moved to Harris Creek and operated over there for a while. This is really the same technology, it's just bigger, better, faster, and stronger.
What was the process in getting this water wheel up like? How did you get funding and approval?
Waterfront Partnership has been a huge help in all of this. They really have been behind us from the very beginning. They raised money from Constellation Energy and the Port of Baltimore. And contract with us to actually build a new wheel. Zigger Sneed architectural firm did the cover structure design, which looks great. Everybody loves it. And that's really how this one happened.
How much did it cost to build this wheel?
$720,000 was the price tag for the actual machine.
And up to 50,000 pounds of trash a day, that's probably worth it in terms of what it's pulling out.
Yeah, we're trying to operate at around $300 a ton removed,
mm-hmm.
whereas a lot of the other systems are up in the $1,000, $1,500 a ton.
Was there any opposition?
Well, it's new technology. People aren't used to it. They weren't sure about it. We had some struggles with the first one. We worked them out. But
what struggles did you have?
Well, just the scale of the trash and natural debris.
The first one, you said the second one is bigger and stronger.
Right.
The first one was not big enough or strong enough to handle.
It did pretty well. We were in there for 8 months. We picked up about 400,000 pounds. But it was just slightly undersized for Jones Falls, which is why they eventually moved it to Harris Creek. It was better suited for that.
Is that because more trash comes out of Jones Falls, or the water level gets so high during
certain...
It's just
the heavy flows that come during the rainstorm. It's a much larger watershed.
Just not enough for the original prototype
right.
to handle, but it can handle other waterways.
Yes.
And this is just an upscaled version, so
it can handle
the larger flows.
It's steel-hulled barges, the wider conveyor, much... more power, electric power from the solar panels we had on the first one.
Solar panels. It is a solar-powered device.
It is. It's current-driven from the river current, and then as backup, we have pumps that pump water onto the wheel that are powered by the solar panels.
just to make sure that there is enough power to keep
right,
that
so we can
going.
Always keep it going. Right now, we pretty much have it running 24 hours a day.
Because through the solar power or because of the
through
currently
the solar power.
Powerful...
Through the solar power. Okay. The current...
Does it
really...
ever not need the solar power to keep running?
When
is
it's
the current
really
ever
pumping.
Enough?
When okay. it's really pumping, after a big rainstorm, the water wheel would turn with just the current. But because there's so much trash, everybody wants it out of there, we go ahead and have the pumps on just to speed up the process.
So it's spinning at all times right. At its highest capacity. Right. And I assume there's enough power that has been generated by the solar power panels to keep it running, even if we have a number of dark days.
Yeah, so it can run for 24 hours with no sun on it at all, which is more than enough, being as we can fill a dumpster in about 2 hours.
Okay. So... It's certainly got enough to keep on going. Have you had offers from other places to build water wheels?
We've had inquiries.
See how this totally plays out.
We've had inquiries from Houston, Miami, India. Apparently, recently.
Really?
We haven't talked to them in depth about it.
Do you know where in India?
I do not. It was just a shot across the bow a couple of days ago.
Cool.
So yes, there is interest. It's a huge problem all around the world. It's not unique to Baltimore Harbor.
India, maybe not developed, but the ones that you have heard from...
Well, Anacostia is another one that we've been talking about them for years about this, ever since...
Down at the Anacostia River,
right.
Down in D.C. area.
Correct. They have a very similar problem, and there's no great way to stop it, so...
So Anacostia might, at some point, get a water wheel...
Hopefully.
What about other sites here around Baltimore? Are there new water wheels in the works?
We have looked at Gwynns Falls as a potential site. It is very similar. Same debris is what comes out of Jones Falls. Mm-hmm. So it could definitely be used over there.
Anywhere else?
In Baltimore Harbor proper, Harris Creek, we'd love to get the prototype up and running again back in Harris Creek if we can pull that off.
What happened? Why is it not up and running in Harris Creek?
It was not well attended after we sold it. It had some maintenance issues, and so eventually they just decided to take it offline.
And so it essentially broke down, but it was still doing its job until then.
It was. It did a great job over there. Picked up a lot of trash.
And it just needs maintenance, you think?
Yeah. A better maintenance program, it would do it a lot of favors.
So that could go back up at some point.
Yeah. Yes.
What about this goal of making the harbor fishable and swimmable by 2020?
I think it's achievable. I think at this point we pretty much have the trash problem licked, or about 80% of it. There's still other outfalls that could be addressed with smaller machines.
But
the big trick to
this wheel is 80% of the trash problem?
Jones Falls generates somewhere between 70% and 80% of the trash that you see in the harbor. It is the major contributor.
And you're getting everything essentially.
Well, pretty much.
You're getting all of the floaters. Some of the stuff that sinks even deeper than the foot that your boom goes down is still sneaking in.
When you get the big flows, it's hard to stop absolutely everything. But we get, I'd say this last week we probably got about 90% of it.
Coming out of Jones Falls.
Right.
And so that leaves 20% other outlets, some of which could be covered by additional wheels.
Well, Harris Creek could be covered by an additional wheel. The other outfalls are much smaller, and that's really more of a matter of not littering. That's really the cure.
So we go back to the topic of the bag ban and other ways to cut back on litter.
Absolutely. That would be a big help.
But fishable, swimmable. That's not just trash. That's chemicals. That's nutrients.
It's chemical. It is a certain amount of sewage.
Mm-hmm.
We have
sewage overflows in this area whenever there's a major rain. That seemed par for the course.
Well, there are more than we would like, that's for sure. And that's really, I think, what's going to be the biggest roadblock to a swimmable harbor.
Daniel Chase is one of the designers of Inner Harbor's new water wheel. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
I'm Nathan Sterner, filling in on this midday Friday for Dan Rodericks. Another short break, then when we get back, an observance of Memorial Day. We'll be joined by local musician Carolyn Surik, who performs in the Celtic music group Trio Galilei. The group takes it upon themselves to perform for wounded veterans every week. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you. That music you're hearing is from the ensemble group Trio Galilei. Our last guest today, Carolyn Surik, is one of the group's founding members. Since 2008, Trio Galilei has been playing free weekly performances to wounded veterans at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, now the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Bethesda. Trio Galilei has put out two CDs based on these performances, with funds going toward the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. Carolyn Surik's book about her outreach work, Between War and Here, includes poems and stories about the veterans she's met along the way. In honor of Monday's Memorial Day holiday, we thought we'd invite her onto the show to tell some of those stories. Carolyn Surik, welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about your group and how it got its start playing for veterans.
Well, it was really interesting. I had this idea that I wanted to go play for, I wanted to take Ensemble Galilei to Walter Reed. And then I tried to get in touch with them and it didn't work. The next year, I finally found a place to play and I went by myself. And I played one afternoon and had a truly extraordinary experience. And so I called my buddies who live in the area who play with Ensemble Galilei, Sue Richards, who lives in Rockville, and Ginger Hildebrand, who lives in Saruna Park. And I'm like, you guys, you gotta come with me. And so that was when the three of us started going there every week.
What was the experience like that made you need to
come
back?
Well, the experience was that I met this young soldier who had been blown up and was in a wheelchair, and he'd lost his leg. And in the course of my interactions with him, we chatted, and I taught him to play the viola da gamba, and he told me about what had happened to him in Iraq, which was just amazing. I mean, he was very, very badly injured and never lost consciousness. He was awake until he got to the hospital, and it had never occurred to me that someone could be that badly injured and still be conscious. Anyway, so we had this extraordinary interaction. And as he was leaving, he turned and he said to me, "Ma'am, this was a once-in-a-lifetime experience." And
wow.
It was so little on my part to just go there and play and talk and, you know, give him a viola da gamba lesson. And it really changed his day. And our goal when we started going there was to make one person's day better, because you're in a place where people have been so extraordinarily affected by radical injury. And if, you know, one Christmas we were there and there was a woman who was sort of so deeply distressed. And she was sitting maybe 10 feet away from us, and she was talking on the phone, and she was, and then after about 15 minutes of her sitting there, she's like nodding her head back and forth with the music, and she's sort of smiling, and I was like, you know, just the power of having live music in a space can really change how that space feels, and it can take it from feeling like a hospital to feeling like one of the world's greatest European hotels, you know? So if you could make that structural change to someone's life, I mean, even for like an hour and a half a day, then you've really actually done something. I mean, that was my theory.
Is that the sort of response that you often get?
Well, it's kind of funny because many of the traumatic brain injury folks and the PTSD folks really have trouble sleeping. And that's why we made the CD, because they would find the music so intensely calming and comforting. And so we made this CD for them. And many of them said, you know, I mean, that it was, they had it in their car and they had it in their room, and that the drugs didn't help. You know, they'd be on all of these different drugs, but it didn't mean they could sleep and it didn't mean that they could calm down. But they could put our CD in and it would work. It would just like work for them. And like just a couple of months ago, this guy comes up and he goes, "I slept for 4 hours." Like, and like, this is this huge accomplishment. So anyway, we are the only band on the face of the earth that feels like when we put people to sleep, we've really succeeded. You know, it's like the music is just really beautiful. It's really calm, but it's kind of designed to just make to sort of transport you into a happier place. And it's not that we play a lot of happy music, because a lot of times we don't. I mean, you really want to play to the feel of the room. And when we were first playing at Malone House at the old Walter Reed, it was so internally dissonant to play something in a major key. I mean, if you played like something in G major, you just felt like it was the wrong thing. And you play something in A minor, and it just would be like totally in the groove of the space of the room. So we really try to play the music that feels appropriate to that moment.
So you don't go in with lists of songs you're going to play.
No, we know.
You decide what you're going to play by reactions,
every
by the way the
second.
Room feels.
I mean, what we actually do is, I mean, we all know, the three of us share about 200 or 300 songs by memory. So
it's relatively easy to.
So you don't have to shuffle
transition.
Through paper. You just, and so, and what we do is we actually trade. Sue will pick the first tune and Ginger will pick the second tune and I'll pick the third tune. And we just do that. So we all play whatever it is that we feel like is the perfect piece for that moment. And that's what we do every week.
Describe the music that Trio Galilei plays. You play the viola da gamba?
Yes.
What exactly is that
I
instrument?
I know.
My grandfather was a concert violist.
Yes, and it has nothing to do with the viola,
exactly.
Actually. It's more genetically related to the guitar. It's an instrument that went out of style in 1750. And
you've brought it back.
Totally. I mean, yes, there are now rock stars who wish they could play the viola da gamba. the viola da gamba is a family of instruments like the violin family, but where the violin family is held on the arm mostly, and they have four strings and they're tuned in fifths, the viola da gamba family are held on the legs. They have six or seven strings. They're tuned in fourths with a third, and they have frets like a guitar has frets, but the frets are movable. So that's what makes it a little more like a guitar. But you bow it like you would bow a cello. I mean, you actually bow it in reverse from the cello, but they are both bowed instruments. So,
what other instruments are used in your
trio? Sue Richards plays the Celtic harp. Mm-hmm. And Ginger Hildebrand, who is a multi-instrumentalist, brings her violin and guitar.
And uses whatever's necessary for the song you're playing.
Yeah.
I know you have a story about a pair of brothers that you recently
met
during
one
of your performances.
Oh my gosh, yeah. You know, the thing about Walter Reed that is incredibly extraordinary is that these people, these men and women are... they're people like you and like me, only they've had this extraordinary experience. And many of them, they're not bitter. They're not grieving their lost life. They're trying to move forward with the body that they now have, or for invisible injuries, with the mind that they now have. And they're not the same as they were before they were deployed. We met these two brothers, and... one of the brothers is in a wheelchair. He was clearly very, very badly injured. And he came in with a gentleman that looked like him. So I was like, oh, they're brothers. And they sat the whole time we were playing. And I said to the brother in the wheelchair, happy or sad music? And he goes, sad. I'm like, okay. And his brother kind of looked surprised. But so we played sad music for the next half hour. And it was beautiful. And then when we were finished playing, we went over to chat with them. And both of them had spent their lives in the army. And one of the brothers had been stationed at the White House. He was the president's right-hand man for his army career. And he was the person who had set up the toothbrush and make sure the TV station was on when the president was out of the country. He was there with the president all the time. And the other brother was deployed most of his career, was, active duty army. And so when the White House, after the gentleman had been at the White House for like 20 years, he was done with the White House career and he said, I'd like to be deployed. And so he went to Iraq while his brother was in Afghanistan, and his brother was in a 3-truck convoy that hit an IED, and his brother was the only person who survived and was without oxygen for 7 minutes. And so when he got to the aid station, they said, well, he will never walk. He'll never talk. He won't be able to feed himself. You know, this is the kind of severe injury that you do not recover from. And when we saw him, he had taken his first steps the week before, and he was going to have lunch, and he had told us sad music. You know, it's like, it's extraordinary. I mean, you see men and women who, are just pushing forward, and it's an extraordinary place to be.
Let's hear a song from one of your group CDs titled Above and Beyond. This piece is called Wayfaring Stranger, and I know it has a special meaning to you. We'll listen to a bit of this song, and then we'll talk about it.
Great, thanks. What you're hearing is Sue Richards playing the Celtic harp. And when you're sequencing a CD, you know, you do the recording and then you have to decide what the order of pieces is going to be. And it's very important for some people, for me in particular, when I'm producing a CD, so that when you start at the beginning and you get to the end of the CD, you've been on a journey. And this piece and Sue's performance of Wayfaring Stranger was so beautiful, but I thought, you know, do we want to start with something happier? Do we want to start with something more upbeat? But really, the guys, our guys and gals who have served, have been wayfaring strangers. I mean, their home, they have a place that they came from, but frequently if they've been deployed, the place that they really feel is home is on the battlefield. It's where their buddies are. I mean, a lot of the guys who have been very badly injured, where they would want to be more than any place else is back there. They want to be back with their company. And it makes it so that life for them is it's a journeyman's life. You know, you're moving from place to place. And home is really where you are. I mean, it's not a place. It's not a geographic location. Yeah, so someone came from, you know, Beckley, West Virginia. But when they get back to Beckley, they're not the same person that they were when they left.
Home's a state of mind.
It is. And it's a state of being. And for many of these guys, it's about being there to protect and serve and to be with their compatriots.
So I guess in a way, some of them will never be home again.
Well, it's a very challenging thing, honestly, for a lot of our guys to figure out where home is when you're done, you know?
You spoke about the brother who wanted to hear sad music.
Yeah.
Do you have people who wanted to hear happy music?
Not very often.
Really?
Not very often. And it's kind of like at Christmas, you say, do you want to hear Christmas music or Irish music? And they say Irish music. I mean, sometimes so we have a couple of people who really want to hear happy music when they come to listen. But there are a lot of people for whom when we speak directly to them through music, the way to speak to them is through sad music. Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Because life is really hard. Like at Walter Reed, everybody's moving forward. Everybody's like working on it. They're going to their physical therapy. They've got their appointments. They're doing all this stuff. But there's no hiding the fact that when you've lost your legs and you can't go to be the person you were before, that there's grieving to be done. And I guess we speak to that.
Maybe happy music would be too sad in a way.
Well, it is kind of like, it's one of the poems in the book talks about that you never say, how are you? You say, how's it going? Because if you say, how are you, then the person has to tell you how they are. And that's too hard. So if you say, how's it going? They go, hey, it's going okay. You know, they're not saying they're okay, but it's going okay.
But it's going okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned your book, Between War and Here.
Yeah.
This is a collection of poems and stories about your experience with veterans. I want you to read one of those poems right now. This is a poem called Brave Mouse. Read it and then we'll talk about it.
Sure. Brave Mouse. Whenever a child walks by we play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Then we change the words and do the alphabet song. The kids sing with us, maybe not right away, but after nestling their heads into their mom's sweater, they peek out and quietly join in. I was playing alone, and a little girl stopped and watched. She smiled at me, and we sang together. Then her mom called, "Come on, time to go. You're taking up too much of that nice lady's time." The next time she walked by with her mom, I asked her if she wanted to play. Her mom was worried that she would hurt the instrument, but I told her it would be fine. The little girl stood to my right, and I placed the bow in her hand, cupped my hand over hers, and we bowed the instrument together. She grinned as we played, and then her mom said, "Come on, honey, time to go." I sat down to lunch near where they were sitting, and the little girl came over. "Are you here to visit your daddy?" I asked, and she looked up at me and said, "My daddy got dead. We're going home today. My grandpa is coming to pick us up." All the air left the room. It was not my place to cry.
The poem Brave Mouse, I take it this was based off of experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It must be hard for you. I mean, there's a benefit that you get, that you feel from playing music for people, but sometimes it must be awfully hard.
Well, you have to not present how you... I mean, we see terribly injured people and terribly sad people, and it is not our place to put ourselves into a tearful spot. You know, it's our place to provide music. And so sometimes we're, you know, we'll be fine, and then we'll leave there and the phone will ring and you'll burst into tears or something. I mean, it's a deeply moving place to live and visit.
And we want to hear a little bit more of your music in a moment, but first let's talk about two upcoming events that you have. Wednesday, June 11th at 6:30 p.m., you're going to be at the Enoch Pratt Free Library giving a talk about your new book, Silently, Shadows Are Sweeping, about love, loss, and forgiveness.
Yes, yes. And also, they've asked me to bring my gamba, so I'll be talking some about Between War and Here and Silently, Shadows Are Sweeping, and doing a little mini concert. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
That's on June 11th at the Enoch Pratt. Then Sunday, June 22nd, Trio Galilei will be performing a benefit concert at 7 p.m. at Baltimore's Church of the Nativity, located at 419 Cedarcroft Road, right?
Yes, yes.
Carolyn Surik, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more information about Carolyn Surik, visit the website uppergreenbooks.com. And thank you so much for listening to Midday Friday. I'm Nathan Sterner in today for Dan Rodericks. He'll be back next week. Also like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guests and for station staff here at WYPR today. Have a great weekend.